Hey there, welcome to Conversations for Financial Professionals, a podcast to help shape the next generation of financial advice. I'm your host, Dominique Henderson, and today's conversation is with Mr. Bob Veras. Bob is the editor and publisher of the Inside Information Guide to Trends and Innovations in the Financial Planning Profession, author of The New Profession, and for 20 years was a contributing editor and columnist for Financial Planning Magazine. He is a journalist, winning several national awards, including the Jesse H. Neal Award for the American Business Media. He's been in this industry as what I would call the godfather or tour guide for anyone in wanting to know anything about financial services. Bob Veras is the man. And in this conversation, we cover the creative ways that we can be addressing the lack of color in the financial services industry. Bob is going to give you some of his insights and ideas about how firms can be more cutting edge and more inclusive versus diverse. This is a very, very important distinction in that most of the insiders he's talked to about the industry are more worried about inclusion versus diversity. He's also going to give us what his thoughts are for the next 15, 20 years in the industry and where this thing is headed from a financial planning standpoint. And we even get into the intersection of life planning and coaching. I really, really enjoyed this conversation, and I expect that you're going to leave with a better understanding about diversity and inclusion inside of financial services. Now to the conversation. Welcome to another episode of the Conversations for Financial Professionals podcast, where we are shaping the next generation of financial advice. Today, I have the one and only Bob Veras. Bob, you are editor and publisher of the Inside Information. You've been, I mean, you're one of these, I would call you almost kind of like the godfather of the profession. I kind of see you as this tour guide of people wanting to understand the ins and out of this journey. So welcome to the podcast, my friend.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. I'm really excited to dive into this topic of, or what I've kind of coined as creative ways to address the lack of color. And no better to do that with a black male and a white man, right?
I don't know. I'm thinking there might be a better solution than having me on, but I'm definitely not an expert in this subject, but I've been worried about it for years.
No, and I think that's a good point, because I think one of the reasons why you're worried about it, I've read a lot of what you've wrote, and I've listened to a lot of where you've talked. And what I can tell, and I think what most people can tell, is that you care about the profession, which is probably the reason why you've been worried about it, because it is a problem.
Yeah, no question.
Well, let me start with this. There's a lot to kind of dive into. I'm not particularly, and even though this is a little, I guess, maybe backwards because of what I just said, but I'm not really into the labels for the sake of labels with black and white. However, there is a lot of people in this industry, obviously, and it's skewed towards a demographic that looks white male, right? Stale, pale, and male is something that I've heard before in the industry. I want to hear your perspective, though, of why, since you do care so much, why is this such an issue from not only the provider of financial services, but I think particularly the consumer of financial services?
Well, you know, this is not, of course, confined to our profession. We have a terrible and centuries-long legacy of having two societies. And the African-American society, and to some extent the Hispanic society, has been systematically discriminated against for, as I said, centuries. And before that, there was slavery. So you have this long-standing legacy of the inability to build wealth that was built right into the way the system worked. And now you have, I think that's finally starting to thaw. I mean, when I was young, it was unthinkable for an African-American man to be an executive. I remember going to the airport and flying and realizing that there was an African-American person, a man, on the plane with me and thinking, boy, that's odd. Mm. That's very strange. And this was in the 1980s, you know, this is not that long ago.
Yeah.
So there has been societal progress, if you will. But in the meantime, there's been this evolution of separate cultures, and necessarily so. You know, when you exclude people based on a visible sign of who they are, the color of their skin, they have to, in turn, create their own society, their own culture. And what we have now, I think, in most lily-white financial planning firms is a discomfort about that culture. And you see that parodied in some of the comics. They talk about, you know, all right, I walk into the office and they immediately want to talk about, you know, some black celebrity, or they want to talk about, you know, stuff that they think I might be interested in. And that discomfort, I think, shows up in our profession. You have somebody who comes in and says, you know, I'm fully qualified to be a financial planner. I've got a degree. I've been doing this for years. And your first thought is, how is this person going to fit in? And would I be comfortable having this person here, not understanding what the cultural issues might be?
Is it a surprise to you that we're still dealing with this at such a large scale? And I know, you know, given you say that it's not exclusive to financial services, but, you know, we're both industry experts here, so we can talk to this industry. Is it surprising to you that it's as bad as it is, or the disparity still exists as wide as it is in 2020?
Well, the simple answer is yes, because I use myself as a reference point, and I don't think I would feel uncomfortable. But as I'll tell you a quick story. My granddaughter signed me up for Facebook some years ago. And, you know, I didn't know anything about social media. So whenever people wanted to be a friend of mine, I clicked on it. And so I ended up being friends with all my former high school buddies. And all my former high school buddies, I played football in high school. And let's just say that many of them are not in danger of being called intellectuals. And their view of the world is very different from mine. Their view is, if we give opportunity to people who have not previously had opportunity, that means they can cut in line ahead of me. And that, I think, explains a lot of the racism in America. It's not necessarily, I see black and I hate it. It's, I see black and I see someone who might pass me in the economic race, rat race, if you will, and I'm afraid of that. And yeah, so therefore, I want to institute policies that will keep that group of people behind me in line.
Yeah, so we're just really talking about the eroding of the moral and social fabric, and really the condition of human beings, because that's to me, that just sounds selfish. Right. More than anything else, it's just me focused attitude first, which obviously I think, you know, in one of the articles you wrote, I think recently, let's call it November or so, it was called Toward a Truly Diverse Profession. You talk about the lost opportunity. And I wonder if you can kind of opine on that a little bit about and unpack the lost opportunity, not only from the standpoint of, I guess, you know, the real, let's call it first order consequence of, oh, I can get more clients if I was, you know, if I had a more diverse or inclusive practice, but also the people that you said that are not going to be reached, that are not even experiencing good financial advice or any type of financial planning in their life because those services don't exist in those communities.
Yeah, I grew up in this profession in the 1980s. And at that time, advisors were working with their peers, and their peers were not wealthy. And one of the untold stories about financial planning is that those big firms that exist today started working with people who were not wealthy and made them wealthy. And then, of course, then they had minimums. You know, as their clients got wealthy, they started saying, oh, we don't work with people under $2 million in assets, which, you know, and I remember these guys, they were buying the cheapest meal at a restaurant because they could hardly afford. And now all of a sudden they're, you know, too big to work with someone who's hasn't got, well, that same dynamic could work, I think, with any population group. You know, you're not wealthy, but you get into really good financial habits. And as you get into good financial habits and as opportunities manifest themselves, and I think there are more opportunities now for all of us, people of color and not, you end up being wealthy. There are certain principles, and those principles are not being taught in the African-American community right now, because for a couple of reasons. One is because I think a lot of black people are a little suspicious of the financial services world. And I think rightly so, because salespeople wander in there and try and sell them all sorts of junk. But and then you have people that say, we only work with people with 2 million assets. Well, what was this about? You know, whatever, I'm going to work with people like that. You know, what are they thinking? But I think there's a real opportunity for that same attitude, that same ethos that started in financial planning to go into underprivileged communities of any color and improve the financial circumstances of millions of people.
No, I love this tangent. I want to stay here for a bit, because when you're talking about underserved communities, I really want to know. So what would be your vision for, let's call it, the industry in the next 10 to 15 years? Because I this is an untold story. You are right. I think, you know, this, let's call it the mid 70s up until probably the early 90s is what you're talking about, where a lot of wealth was created. I guess what I'm confused about, as you tell me what your vision is for this, I'm confused about where this starts. Does it start at the practitioner level? Does it start at the university program level with education? Like, where do we start so that we can get more boots on the ground, actual planning happening in these communities?
Well, I think all of the above, but I can kind of tease it all out, if you will.
Okay, do that.
And this is just my suggestions, you understand. But
okay, no, I think I like the banter. Let's go.
The suggestions seem to be reasonable, and I think they might even be affordable if there was a commitment to doing it, and that's what we don't really have right now. We have a lot of talk. And every time we talk, I say, you know, I do interviews and I say, well, what tangibly are you doing? And they say, well, we're still at the beginning. We're still talking. We're still figuring it out. Well, we need to get past the talking stage, I think. So that's the first thing. And there needs to be real commitment. So real commitment to what is the question you're asking, I think.
Yeah. I think so. So let me throw in parenthetically. So we have, I went to Prairie View A&M, historically Black college and university, and was surprised to find out through my reading a couple of weeks ago that Mackenzie Scott has been on a rampage of like donating. And one of the gifts that she gave was a $50 million charitable gift to Prairie View. And I have friends inside the financial planning program there that, as a minor. And I'm wondering, I'm like, okay, this is a start, but I don't even know where this money is going to be allocated, right? I have no idea. As alumnus, but it's stuff like this where university programs, now granted, this is a once in a lifetime type of endowment, but how is these funds being used across the university? And maybe specifically for programs like you're talking about and that you've alluded to in previous writings.
Well, what I'm suggesting is the financial planning profession as a whole needs a department of financial planning. And we don't have one right now. What we have is, you know, they're just pieces of, They're attached to other schools. So if there was a financial planning department or school that was endowed and had its own building, so you went to the building and there were professors of financial planning and you came out with a degree in financial planning, which is also rare. I think there's only two colleges that give you a degree. You get other things that they're called. But
certificates, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so what I think the best, easiest, fastest way to kill as many birds, I'm not really big on killing birds, but it's a phrase, killing two birds with one stone, or three or four maybe, is to go to one of the historically black colleges and endow a department of financial planning and have that school graduate financial planners. And then have other colleges look and see how successful that can be. But in the meantime, you're graduating African-American financial planners who will populate. And, you know, maybe when I go to the next conference, I'll see more than one or two faces in the audience, you know, maybe five or six, you know, let's hope, let's dream, you know. And that would start something. That it would start several things. Number one, it would start the academic, it would address the academic issue in the profession. And number two, it would address the what they call diversity. I prefer inclusion. I've talked to people who say that inclusion is really the goal. And so address the inclusion issue. But then you ask a different question. The communities that have been underserved by financial planners, I think we can also endow practices. And I've talked to people who've actually done this, but they you can't really go into a community where people can only afford to pay you $50 for your advice at a time, you know, and maybe they'll pay you $100 if you do their tax return. That's not a sustainable model, but it could be endowed so that that business is kept alive for 5 or 10 years.
And well, and I'm sorry.
You'll see a certain amount of wealth being built up, and maybe that business becomes sustainable. And if you do that for 50 or 100, then I think you could make a real dent.
I don't know that it's not a bad idea as an addendum to that, as if you did endow a particular, you know, college of financial planning at, let's say, a historically Black college and university, that the CFP track candidates, which you would assume most of them will be, could then even start to do some of the pro bono planning under supervision, under CFPs that would, you know, be practitioners, or they're already in academia. Maybe they don't have their own practice, but they have the CFP marks. Right. This work can be supervised. And instead of, you know, graduating, being ready for the CFP exam, and you can pass the test and then got another 2 years to get the hours, maybe you can be doing this while you're in school also. And it gives you this hub where the community can come for financial planning that's already at the college.
That's actually a great idea. And it's not something, I just want to put on the record, it's not something I thought of, but it's a great idea.
But I mean, when I'm, you know, I face a lot of career changes, I face a lot of aspiring financial professionals. And one of the bigger things that I think is, and granted, this is not as big a number as the traditional undergrad student, I get it. But there are a lot of career changers with transferable skills that are ready to enter this industry. And then they see the track of CFP and they go, this is probably a 3 or 4 year journey that involves a lot of change, not to mention the financial portion of it. And it's not to say that it's not a worthwhile journey. It's just, it's going to take a while at that particular clip. Right. And I think if universities, just to be frank, stop fighting over students, this could be a really, really good solution to the problem.
Well, you're closer to it than I am. And I agree with everything you're saying, assuming that what you're saying is correct. And it sounds like it is.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. So I have a lot of people that that kind of look to me for mentorship, and I'm pretty sure you too, obviously. And I want to kind of maybe pivot just a little bit and leave them with some maybe firms or organizations that you feel that are kind of on the cutting edge of what we're talking about. And I don't know if you mind name dropping at this point, but people that are, you know, kind of seeing the vision for where this industry is headed. And if people want to put their names in the hat at those particular firms or do some more research, maybe they could.
Yeah, I'm not sure that I can cite specific firms. I mean, there are a lot of them that seem to be good companies out there. I can talk about what kinds of services that advisors, I think, should be offering. You know, I think the XY Planning Network is doing a great job of facilitating people working on their own and starting their own businesses. And when I talk to younger advisors, I say, you know, I really think that should be your goal. Instead of working for a firm and maybe getting, you know, 5% of the firm after a long...
Why do you say that? I'm curious.
Excuse me?
Why do you say that? I'm curious.
Well, the tradition, the firms that I talk to are typically run by people I grew up with. And those people are, you know, do I really want to make any substantive changes based on all the evolution that's going on in the profession? Or maybe I should just ride it out until I retire. And I talk to an awful lot of frustrated younger advisors who want to work with their peers and they want to work more deeply with clients. They want to change the model. They want to change the technology. And, you know, every time they make a proposal, the founder of the firm says, well, it's taking money out of my pocket. Why would I do that? And so who wants to inherit that relic of a firm that finally, when the person dies in his desk, they end up with, you know, I don't know that that's really, and I hate to say that because these are people who are really great people in the business when they started out. They founded financial planning, but they're now, many of them are obstacles to what we need to have happen. So yeah, work with a firm for 3 or 4 or 5 years, get experience, learn some things, but don't necessarily make a commitment to a firm that's not evolving.
What are your thoughts, just to park there for a second, what are your thoughts about the, I think I know the answer here, but I would love for you to actually publicize it. What are your thoughts on the brokerage model, the wirehouse model? I call it the broken dealer. I know there are some people in organizations that do a great job, try to provide their advisor, the people in the organization with great tools. But for the most part, I think that it can be done so much better and more efficiently in the independent model. What are your thoughts there?
Well, I kind of like the broken dealer. I have run into excellent brokerage firm reps, and I tell them, please, would you go independent? Because I would like to say that every wirehouse rep is a dirtbag, and I can't say that with full honesty and integrity as long as you're working at this firm. So, and they laugh, and then we have another drink, and that's kind of the end of the conversation. You know, they're a little too comfortable where they are, and they're not really ready to do that. But I don't think there's any question that you can give a lot better advice independently than you can if there's a firm that's supervising what you say. And more importantly than that, you know, when you leave the brokerage world, you can finally start talking to your clients like an adult. You're not, you know, compliantly, there's no compliance officer monitoring everything you say. So, you know, I think that model is not going to survive the next iteration of the profession, but that's just a prediction. Who knows the future?
No, I think it will take a long time for this dinosaur to die out, because it's a pretty big one. It's like one of the bigger ones, you know, like a flesh-eating Tyrannosaurus Rex or something like that. But the point is I think you break a lot of points. And I think one of the main points around compliance with our, you know, 80-year-old regulation and Investment Advisor Act, that hasn't changed with the times. I think, you know, you start thinking about how most compliance officers are probably pretty good people. They're not like just trying to be out there, but they got to manage to the lowest common denominator. So that's the reason why you can't really say anything in that world. I think, to your point, clients do like the independent model for all that it brings, with the ability to take away this, you know, what do I want to call it, kind of whitewashed approach to financial services and make it a lot more human, which is what people are craving, I think is maybe what you're probably bringing out in that, in your
opinion there. Well, and the other thing too is the profession is evolving rapidly, and I hope we get to talk about some of that. And the brokerage firms are not evolving rapidly. That's not how they're working. They may want to, but you know, if you're steering a dinosaur, the dinosaur takes a while to turn around, you know?
Yeah. No, let's talk that. I want to, let's unpack that for a second. The evolution of the industry. Cause I think, you know, and you can give a better history of this than I can, but you know, you basically have this fixed product, commission-based insurance or whatever model that everything is pretty much born out of. And that's permeated for, you know, for a long time. And even in some instances is still around. And then you get this AUM model, which I think everybody's kind of got used to for the most part. And then the fee only versus the fee based and all this other kind of stuff kind of crops up. I think I would love for you to kind of opine on where you kind of see. I've heard Mark Tabergeon talk about this at conferences, and the next level is this. Obviously, you got to have the IQ and the competence, but a real high level of EQ and active listening for the new client advisor dynamic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have given whole presentations just on this subject, but the short version of it is that we're in several transitions at the same time right now. The sales model is pretty much on the way out, but all the independent broker dealers are trying to phase out their top salespeople and put everybody under an AUM model, because that's the way everybody makes more money and it's more efficient. And it's also more palatable to clients. But the AUM model is phasing itself out right now at the same time, more slowly, and we're in a much earlier phase of that. But you know, investments are commoditized. I don't talk to any advisors who are adding significant alpha to client portfolios. So why are clients paying out of the portfolio when they should be paying directly for advice? So the next iteration of the profession is going to be fee for service, and XY Planning Network is pioneering that. And The Alliance for Comprehensive Planners is pioneering it to some extent, flat fees or subscription fees. It's a small percentage of the population, but that's where the action is right now. So there's that. And then there's the, we've moved from a focus on what can I sell you to a relationship with the portfolio, a relationship with the golden eggs rather than the goose that lays them. Mm. And the next, the frontier, and what I think is a number of advisory firms are crossing, is they're focusing on the client, not the portfolio. And that's part of the same transition, you know, from AUM to financial planning. But even beyond that, I think we're moving to, I think where the frontier is life planning, coaching, and specialization in particular kinds of clients. And that could be underserved, unwealthy clients. That could be, you know, dentists coming out of dental school or in their residency. That could be any niche that you understand better than anybody else. And if you apply life planning skills, coaching skills, business planning skills, all of a sudden you're offering a better service than anybody else.
No, I like that, especially the life planning. I read a lot of George Kinder. Maybe you're referring to some things that he's done to or not, but I think the concept of it still is intact just because of, you know, at the end of the day, I don't think anybody, and I've been to plenty of funerals, nobody, I've never seen a Brinks truck following a hearse. So you can't take it with you. It's all about what can be done with your limited time and money while you're here across unlimited choices. And I think, you know, financial planners, good ones, are great facilitators for those particular conversations. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. And I think most people have kind of given up on their goals. That's the interesting thing, is that when you talk to people about, you know, what do you want in your life? A lot of times you start to uncover things that people really don't believe they can do, but they've always wanted to.
Now, I think that's a notion around, and I say this a lot, is, you know, as kids, we dream a lot, but we get to adults and we stop dreaming. Right. I think there's an aspect of delayed gratification that's great, but at the same time, you know, why do you want to work 30 or 40 years at a job that you kind of like to have this pile of money that you may or may not accumulate? Like, are there any ways that you can enjoy this on the way? I guess is kind of the point versus the 30 or 40 years down the road.
Or improve your economic condition. You know, a lot of people, you know, if they take a year off and invest in retraining themselves or reeducating, they can come back in as, you know, as better, more effective participants in our economic system. There are so many possibilities. I mean, they're unlimited. We could spend the rest of the time talking about that. But I think the point is that you need to have that person redream, if you will. Start redreaming. Start getting in touch with the things that they've always wanted to be and do.
No, I love that. And I think that's across all communities, underserved or not. That's just what I think good financial planners do. What comes to mind when you hear the word coaching? This is one of those subjects that you either know you need it or not. So I'm not here to try to convince you need a coach, because that would be a waste of both your and my time. However, what I'm here to tell you is that as an existing financial professional, you might find yourself inconsistent or even frustrated when you compare your success to that of your peers. Why is that? I'm gonna tell you, it's because you have more potential inside of you that has yet to be reached. Enter Jumpstart Performance Coaching. Having consulted with some of the top advisors in the country for the last few years, and having built my own wealth management firm, I realize what it takes to get you and your team to the next level. As a Jumpstart Performance Coaching client, you and I are going to work together on a custom plan to absolutely crush your goals with no BS and no fluff. If you're not reporting success by our third interaction, I'm going to give you your money back. Look, if you're serious about getting to the next level and want some assistance, I want you to go to www.jumpstartcoachinglab.com/coaching right now, and let's take your performance to another level while there's still some spots available. Now let's get back to our conversation. There's a lot of resources out there nowadays, and I want to highlight inside information. I think you have some really great information in there and some resources. I want to really kind of talk about how I think what I'm calling tomorrow's financial professional can use it to better their client relationships. Can you just give us a little bit of tidbits of some things that are in that publication and where that's taking, let's call them thought leaders or just leaders in this industry?
Well, you know, every issue is different. And I basically what I do is I used to call people, but now I don't. Now people send me, you know, I've been doing this, or I just saw somebody present that or something. Or even better, somebody will send me a message and say, "Bob, you're full of shit." And then they'll explain why. And a disturbing percentage of the time, they're right. And so I have to go back in and figure out, you know, something that I didn't know, you know. And
it just means you're self-aware, man. That's great.
And so, you know, it's practice management. It's how to manage a business. It's how to start a business. It's the frontiers of client service. It's anything that's new and different and better is what I try and bring to people. I did a whole issue on compliance, which is a really exciting subject, I have to tell you. But it was about people's actual experiences with remote audits with the SEC and what they were talking, what they were seeing, what they were experiencing, what questions were asked, you know, and it turned out to be a pretty entertaining issue somehow.
I actually just had one of those. It was a very different experience I've been through four, with the time in the industry, I've been through four FINRA/SEC audits. And this was a very interesting desk audit being done remote with the COVID year that we had.
Well, I wish you'd gotten in touch with me. I could have interviewed you as part of it.
I will say this. I think that what we're seeing is that the Byzantine nature of some of these institutions, including the SEC and most of, I would think at maybe even probably at a greater scandal, grander scale at the state level, which I'm in state of Texas. I am still waiting on my results.
Oh, really?
Yeah. This was August. And I know that federal institutions and government institutions have been just shellacked by the pandemic. And so I'm just attributing to that. But yeah, I talked to the auditor and we're still waiting on results.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, you know,
the actual written results, but of course I'm good to go.
Well, someday the regulators are actually going to be focused on protecting consumers instead of harassing people. But I'm going to hold my breath and see if that happens. Okay, so let me start.
You might be holding your breath for a long time, Bob.
We'll see if I survive this breath holding thing.
That's great. Well, this is a podcast to empower tomorrow's financial professional with tools to better serve their clients. The whole arc and scope of the discussion that we had. And I really appreciate you giving us your thoughts there. But in that context, what word or words of wisdom do you have for the next generation of financial professionals?
Well, the first thing I tell them is to make a commitment to work with your peers, that you have a sacred obligation to bring the financial planning, the benefits of financial planning to people your age. And if the firm you work for is not willing to allow you to create a model that will allow you to work with your peers, then that's the wrong firm for you to commit to. And so the time will come when you go out on your own or you go to a better firm or whatever. And that means you can't, you know, a lot of younger advisors, the founder of the firm says, you need to start marketing the firm and you need to start bringing in clients. So I want you to bring in 65-year-old aging decumulators who have more than $2 million under management, which is not the circles that most 25 and 30-year-olds travel in. And you know, they come to me and they say, "Oh, I'm not sure how I'm going to do this. You know, I'm going to give speeches at the Rotary Club or what?" You know, the way that you have to charge that cohort of younger advisors is by fixed fees of some sort. And I'll tell you, I'll give you a model that I think is really great. There was an advisor when I spoke at a conference in Birmingham, England, which is not a town I recommend you visit as a tourist, by the way. And there was a guy from Brazil who had created a really big firm, and his the way he pitched his services was very interesting. He said, right now you're living on 100% of your income. And the answer is, yes, I am. I propose to you that instead of 100%, you live on 95% of your income, and you'll pay me 5%, and we'll do this for 3 months. And if at the end of 3 months, you want to go back to living at 100% of your income, if I haven't made a significant difference in your life, then you go back. Otherwise, you continue to pay me 5% of your income, and I will make your financial life better, easier, and give you confidence in the way you're navigating our financial landscape. And pretty much everybody signs on, and pretty much nobody signs off. I think it's a great model, and I think you can make a really good business by simply doing that. Now, you have to be able to deliver on that promise. And that's not a small thing. And that requires a lot of energy, particularly when you're kind of inventing it at the beginning. But if you invent a model where you're helping people save, invest, budget, and normalize all the other complications of your financial life, you know, like, are you paying too much for your insurance coverages? Are you, you know, are they overlapping or not? Your taxes, you know, is that being handled efficiently? You're putting aside money in the right accounts, if that makes sense. But if you do that, I think you can bring an awful lot more value than what you're charging for. And it's a really good way, I think, to position yourself as an advocate for people financially.
I love the positioning of that approach. And I think it gets back to, you know, the first statement that you made is, if there's a word of wisdom there, it's to concentrate on your peers. I think one thing that I've seen with advisors, you know, big and small, especially, you know, people that are, you know, first starting out, they think they have to approach the universe of clients as their clients. And you said something earlier about niches and specializations. I think it's so key. And you can really pull off with this. You don't have to, let's say, overpromise and underdeliver in this particular pitch if you specialize, right? I mean, if you're only talking to carpenters or electricians or tradespeople, then there's your niche. You don't have to worry about the, you know, baby boomer that comes to you. You tell them, I'm not the best firm for you, find someone else. So I think that's an excellent approach. I love it.
And it helps to look at your own, the things that you enjoy. I'll give you one niche that I think is the most interesting I've ever heard about. Somebody was, he was a pitcher for the Clemson baseball team that played in the College World Series. And so then he joined his dad's firm as a financial planner, and he started offering a service where he would do college planning for people, and he would meet with the baseball players in the community, the best baseball players in the community, and have group meetings and say, let me tell you how to position yourself to be recruited so that you can play baseball in college. And he would get the film, he would organize that, he would send out the film to different schools, he would figure out which schools were best for which prospects. And usually you start off at a Division II school because you can play immediately, and then you can transfer to a Division I school. And so it was a really good, fun niche that allowed him to do something he really loved. And also, of course, he was doing the college aid forms, and then he would say, you know, you've got this and this and this, I can help you with your taxes, and I can help you with your investments.
Yeah, I think our industry has, the marketing of our industry has really brainwashed a lot of people to not think outside the box. Like we're doing so much to be like the next person that we're, you know, comparing ourselves to or whatever. And therefore, what we don't realize, though, I don't think that's it's lost on advisors that, well, the public doesn't see any difference either. So there's no reason why they want to work with you. But everybody wants to see a specialist as opposed to a generalist, especially when it comes to medicine. So I don't think it would be any different with financial services.
If you can help me with reaching my goals, I will always be loyal to working with you. One more piece of advice that I give is ask your clients to write down, I say 30 goals, because 30 goals is hard. That makes it a difficult process, and you start uncovering things that maybe you wouldn't have written down before. And then keep track of the goals that your clients are achieving while they're working with you, which is a perfect life planning engagement. And as you keep track of them achieving those goals, as they're achieving their personal goals, some of them may be as simple as having dinner with a family, which they haven't done, you know, or having breakfast with a family. Or it may be as complicated as finally finishing that PhD or finishing writing that novel. And you hold them accountable for those goals. You say, how are you doing on those goals? You coach them a little bit. I think coaching is part of it. If they're achieving their goals, then they will never leave you, because that's the point. That's it. That's the whole reason that you want to have a relationship with a professional.
No, that's excellent. I mean, man, you're opening up a whole nother can of worms here. I'm gonna have to have maybe I can have you and you back and have Sandra Davis on here also to talk about the.
I just interviewed and profiled Sandra Davis for this issue of the newsletter.
Yeah, she's a good friend. But yeah, I think the intersection of coaching into financial services at, you know, the financial planning component, I think is so key. I get a lot of career changers, aspiring financial professionals that look at my program and then they go, well, I don't know that I really want to do the CFP. I don't even really like the investment stuff. What is this coaching thing? And then we talk about that and they're like, oh, well, this is what I really want to do. And I think more than a noun or a verb, it's really this way of being or showing up for your clients and the people that you're in relationship with that are trying to reach your goals. So that's what I'm hearing, at least from the Sandra Davises of the world and you.
Yeah, I would hope that they would continue to pursue the financial expertise, because I think that's a component of it. But if you have me and Sandra on, it'll be Sandra talking and me saying, yep.
No, I totally get that. I totally get that. Well, Bob, this has been great, man. I'm gonna let you run. I know that you're busy, and I really appreciate you coming on and spending this amount of time and sharing your wisdom with this audience. It's been great.
Well, I've really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you for this.
All right. Thank you. Take care. Have a great one. Hey there. I really hope you enjoyed this conversation. Before we go, just a few things. The best way to retain what you just learned is to do more than just listen. First, you need to write down your most important takeaway, and then you need to give yourself a deadline to apply it. For bonus points, you might also let someone hold you accountable to that deadline. Also, remember, the only way more people will know about this podcast is if you share it. You can do that by sharing a link to this episode on your social media or by leaving a review on iTunes so that it reaches a wider audience. I'd appreciate if you took the time to do either or both. And finally, if you'd like to join my free community to learn more about how you can become a next generation financial professional, please text me at 214-544-9226. I love to hear from you and point you in the right direction. Bye for now, until our next conversation.